And way across the horizon, deep in the hills, thunder is coming, echoing valley. An elven king, gentle, his master moves in robes of wind.
Good afternoon and welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. I'm Janaea and I'll be with you from 3 until 4, possibly 4 until 5. Alan Fisher will be here from 4 to 5. And we're going to be speaking shortly when he calls in with Alan Sabalta about the wisdom of the fire. He is a firekeeper extraordinaire of the Native American ceremony Inipi. Many of you know it as Sweat Lodge, as well as history and the ways in which we've been lied to and filter our history as a result of the misinformation that most of us were given in public schools, private schools as well, and how it creates negativity and fear within us. And I'm going to check in with him, and he'll be on shortly. And in the meantime, we're listening to one of my favorites, Warriors on the Way. Enjoy.
No place like home. And there's no place like home. Ring them bells for life. There's no place like home.
Good afternoon. This is Janaea tickling the belly of the beast, and I do have Jesse on the line now, and we're going to be speaking with Jesse Sabala, and he's going to be speaking about, first of all, I'll give a little introduction. He's a musician, researcher, and through his exploration into music, he discovered a bit more about spirituality and in the ways in which it touched his heart, and particularly the fire within his, burning within his heart and his soul. And it's interesting because he is a fire keeper, keeper of one of the sacred fires in Indian Canyon and Hollister. Jesse, are you with us?
Yeah.
Hi. Great. Can you speak up just a little bit?
Sure.
There. That's better. Great. Now, Jesse, do you just want to say a little bit about yourself to our listeners? Now, I said that you were a musician, researcher, and that I do know about you, and the ways in which spirituality has impacted you and literally set your soul on fire.
Well, throughout my whole life, I've kind of been closely connected in and out through different ways and with very centered and kind-hearted people, but up until the teenage years, other messages and other things start to come in and maybe cloud things for people, and you start to lose that sense. And so it had to come back to me. I can say through and it did through music, and I've had many experiences in spirituality and areas, and it's always driving me towards that. And and also the things that feed the soul, such as music and other arts, writing, mm-hmm. cooking, or anything of that matter. But my first pass was music, and through music came truth and knowledge in many forms, which all pointed me into wanting more truth mm-hmm. and real history, as to why people are so separated from each other and their true mm-hmm. selves.
I've always learned so much from you in our ceremony, the Inipi, the Sweat Lodge, and you're our firekeeper at Indian Canyon. And I marvel at the ways in which you seem to comprehend simple truths, and sometimes not so simple. But you have a simple way of explaining complexities. And the first thing, in a beautiful manner that can be utilized practically in life, but how exactly did music impact you?
Well, it impacted me through many ways of just first scratching the surface of what is the soul and what does it do, what can it do, what's the difference between the soul and your brain, and all these questions that I'm sure everybody asks themselves. And I found that through music it helped me to find out the other half of me, which was the spirit half of myself, and the brain had been running my life the whole time and been neglecting the voice that was my spirit, my soul, the wants that make everybody happy, truly happy inside. And so I started listening to those.
Kind of filled that hole.
Yes, yes. And so with music and through, you know, different artists also who bring a lot of light to human cultures, gave me a lot of my early teachings beside my parents in life and spirituality. So,
what kind of music do you play?
I play reggae, blues. I play really anything that's real, I guess I can say, that's from the soul, that's not manufactured or pieced together by people trying to make money off of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I gravitate towards, so I'm not really particular in any genre.
I know this interview is being conducted over the phone. Is there anything you would feel comfortable sharing over the phone? A song or something that has really touched you? And do you write your own music?
Yeah, I do write my own music, but I think for today I'll just be sharing an introductory prayer to begin the talking points. And so if it's okay, I'd like to start that.
Oh, please do. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, Creator, thank you so much for this day. Thank you for all things in this day. Thank you for all the food you give us to eat, all the water you give us to drink, the earth you give us to walk on, the sights and sounds you give us to experience, Creator. I thank you so much, and I ask you to please bless all the souls that give their life for our food and all the souls that lift their hands to bring the food to our plates. Thank you, Creator, for all the cycles of life, from the minerals to the roots, from the roots to the trunk, from the trunk to the branches, from the branches to the leaves that make the air, that go to the clouds that make the rain that fall back down to the earth, to the minerals, replenishing the cycles. Thank you for all the cycles of life, Creator, and for all things in all seven directions. Thank you.
Thank you, Jesse. That was beautiful. Can always count on you to have an amazing prayer. And the other day, after ceremony, we were talking about fear. And I'd like you to start sharing a little bit about that, the history, and the negative ways in which we are programmed.
Well, you know,
through that misinformation,
being semi new to Lakota ways, but not new to the ways of the spirit, I've found many things be brought to light through the ways of the Anipi, and a lot of them that I noticed, you know, that I can say from my own experiences only, is that when each time that I come out of there, I can say that a new fear is wiped off of my body, or that as the first time, from the first time until now, I've only been expelling different fears and being and having full realization of what exactly it is that I'm getting rid of each time, and why, and how it was programmed into my brain to be afraid, you know, since I was a child, you know, and how it was programmed into my parents to be afraid, and how it's programmed into their parents. And
that's beautiful
insight.
And
so forth. And so, you know, I find that, you know, a lot of people's huge fears are caused just by the smallest fears. And once you get the smallest fears and the most base fears out, it kind of starts to easily eliminate all of the fears that radiate from those. So, you know, there's a line of history, you know, and it goes, you know, of fear, and it starts from the beginning, I guess, of recorded time in the books, but you can say that as recently, it starts with the English and then how they persecuted the pilgrims. The pilgrims left because they were afraid. They come to this country. They see people who they don't know, and they don't know how they live. They're afraid of them, so they start killing those people. And so, you know, they create problems and work, so they have slaves, and then pretty soon the slaves get freedom, so then they're afraid of the slaves with freedom. So then they pass gun laws again so that, you know, slaves can't own guns. And then so on and so forth. Again, it spreads from there, and then it goes to, you know, to from there to the Arabs, and then now into the new fear, which is Mexicans. So it's kind of a consistent spread, and it all kind of, you know, if you want to get into the to the core, I think that it starts with the books, with you know, with the Bible, and I love the Bible. But I feel that all of the other cultures are not being heard, so it makes the Bible harder to understand. And so, with commonalities between science and between science now and between all literature, saying that there was a flood, saying, you know, that in the Bible, saying that it was because the angels were mingling with humans, and in all of the books throughout the world, whether it be Mayan or Egyptian, it's saying that it happened because of those reasons, but also because that man was corrupt, and that there is a certain level of corruption that we reached. And I feel that the starting point in the Bible is to instill fear to not go down those roads again, because it seems to have failed through four previous worlds, five previous earths. People have been living this way, and it's been happening in a continuous cycle. And so
So instead of instilling fear as a learning mechanism, possibly love, or
what?
There are other ways of teaching us how to be more cooperative with one another and to live more in harmony and balance with the land, the mother, and the animals, with life. Keep talking. Someone just arrived. I'm just going to let them into the studio. One moment. And I'll be right back.
And, you know,
Sorry about that. I had to let someone in. Jesse?
Yes.
Hi. All right. Sorry for the interruption. I had to let someone in.
And let's see. And so, getting back to what you're saying, is there an alternative? And yeah, it is. It is the whole love alternative, and that is what the Bible, you know, tried to accomplish in many ways, but also had to instill the disciplinary aspect, which I feel that the rest of the world has to offer to the Christian community and vice versa. And I feel that it's the left and the right hand, and they can not only fix and find out each other's truths, but they can also be each other's balancing, you know, as a science to religion and religion to science. You know, everything is useful. There's useful and useless, and when they're used right, they can.
I love that phrase, useful and useless.
And that's really what I deem fear.
Yeah, can you share a little bit more about that?
Well. Fear, you know, to me, I found that my whole life that it's kept me from doing things that I really wanted to do in my soul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you hear yourself say, oh, well, I would really love to do this, but, oh, I'm this or that, I'm too this, you know, I'm too tall, or I'm too fat, or I'm too tired, or I'm too lazy, I'm this or that.
Sure.
And so people are always instilling this small little level of fear, which is self, you know, self-confidence, lack of, and which keeps people, you know, consuming. I guess you know, it really does. When you have people afraid of one thing or another, they're buying something to protect themselves. So it's really just I feel that this whole fear thing is now to this day being fed in ways to keep an economy going, whereas. And it's creating a lot of disorders. psychological and whatnot. But
and what can you say about keeping the economy running and the ways in which it is and the fear behind not making enough, not having enough, not being enough? So it sounds like you've thought deeply.
Well, I just feel that when you're making decisions anywhere but from the center, you're gonna come in, you're gonna run into brick walls, or you're gonna have shortcomings. So, you know, although there's so many decisions being made out of fear, the initial one was, you know, to have the Federal Reserve made. And since the beginning of the Federal Reserve, we've been in debt. Mm-hmm. When we've escaped, when we've tried not to be taxed by going to war with England, we're going right off the bat, we instill the Federal Reserve, and for every dollar that we print, they're getting $2. So it's like, you know, and so just straight from that, the first fear tactic was fighting against Europe. Well, the next one was, oh, well, what are we going to do? Well, let's take the first thing that comes along. It's the easiest, and they made a decision out of fear, and so on and so forth. And so now you have an endless consuming monster that is eating itself. It's the snake eating its own tail, you know, as many cultures have to represent time. It's very much like that. It never stops consuming itself.
Okay, yeah, well spoken. It doesn't stop consuming itself, and it's consuming us in the process.
Absolutely.
I often think that. I had someone on not very long ago, and I spoke at length about how we are being consumed by the consuming culture and the fear that is so widespread.
Yes, yeah. It's becoming something that's getting to a point where people are either going to have to wake up or just wake up one day and see even more, if it's possible, even more worse things in the world happening, because these are all results of the machine that needed to be fed, you know, that everybody has to go to work for, and everybody has to go do this. It's something that everybody's going to have to either say, we're all going to stop this, and we're all going to try to do something different, or we're just going to fold and not do anything, because right now it's not about a debt thing or about stimulating this or that or any of this right now. It's so far gone and it's so bad right now that that there needs to be a radical change, because it's only going to create more debt or the latter. You're going to run out of resources and you go to war with other countries, which we're already pretty much doing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's all based from that fear, and the way that they keep us going to these countries is by having a new enemy, a new someone to fear.
Yeah.
You have to have someone to fear. You have to keep a nation together. This is an old saying. To keep a nation together, you have to have a common enemy.
Yeah, and also and that works. Common enemy to fight at war, and right now, the fear of our survival appears to be so much more at stake. We keep hearing on the radio, the news constantly, but there aren't enough jobs.
Yeah.
There's food prices, commodity prices, everything is going up, gasoline, and people are becoming more competitive and looking at others as competition.
There is that fear again of the fear that someone who has billions of dollars is going to run out of money and that they need to keep making money.
It's endless.
Yeah.
It's a greed. But what have you found would work as an alternative? What world do you envision? There's a song I want to play at some point, too. We can take a little break here in a few minutes. It's a Beautiful World in Existence.
Well, you know, if I can envision what should happen, I would say that it would be good that if everybody within themselves, first of all, reflected a little bit, even the people who think that they're really good, to see what more that they can do for people who are within their reach and who are within their vicinity to help, you know. And on a global standpoint, I would say that if you really wanted to radically change things and to get the balance of the Earth Mother back in the flow and all these things, then you would have to stop killing people, which would mean stop fighting the wars, and to take all your soldiers, because they're not warriors, they're soldiers, take all your soldiers and have them go clean up all these messes that need to be cleaned up in the world, as far as Haiti, as far as Japan, as far as
all the disasters
forgotten. As far as Christchurch, as far as all these places that are still in ruins pretty much, and no one's even helping, or if they are donating, who knows where that money's going, as usual. So, you know, it's come to a point that it needs to change radically. It's no longer a let's put on the news and see what needs to be done, let's see what we can do to change things. It's been beyond that point, you know.
And what I hear is not so much an urgency, but you realize the preciousness of life and how valuable it is, and therefore important to take action that works to perpetuate life. Mm-hmm. That's what I hear.
Yeah, and definitely I do think that, but they've taken that message also, and they've distorted that message into green technology.
Can you give me an example of how?
Well, now you have a bunch of things being made that are saying that they're green technology, but they're being made from oil products.
Yeah.
And they keep on putting out more and more of these green products. Well, the more green products you have, the more oil consumption, obviously, that's going on. And a lot of these green products are going to help these oil spills. Like, if you buy these products, if you buy these products, it'll go to help against the next oil spill. This is before the BP disaster happened.
They're perpetuating that. Oh my, I wasn't aware of that. But it doesn't surprise me in the least.
So it's kind of just like a bee. Like I said, it's a snake eating its tail. They're feeding themselves. This is what they're doing. They're consistently feeding themselves. So yeah, we're green and everything, but we're owned by oil companies. Because they know that everybody's going to want to buy green products, so they're going to buy all the green companies. So it's becoming that they're starting to find a way to distort the message of being environmental, you know, and being organic, you know what I mean?
Yes, and then the term organic is often misused. And, you know, one thing I really enjoy every time I talk with you, you encourage me to think more deeply about what is around me and how I walk my talk or don't. And you have an immediacy and presence about what you see, and you can delve deeply. And I just want you to know that my co-host just arrived, Alan, and he wants to share something with you also.
Sure.
And Alan, we're speaking with Jesse Cibola. He's a musician researcher.
Hello, Alan.
Hi. Good to meet you.
I just had to let him in. That was that brief interruption. And we're talking about the ways in which we've been programmed into fear throughout our culture. I mean, we could talk at length about this, but what did you want to share?
Well, I mean, I think it's endemic that the wars, you know, the whole assassination of bin Laden, if that's actually what happened, because there's a lot of possibilities that he was killed long ago or that he never existed or many different things.
Yeah.
But that this was used to, you know, drum people into these huge wars that have bankrupted, you know, the world. And that fear has been used throughout history to keep the population in line, both with direct threats and through indirect threats of, say, terrorism or something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a definite truth on the fact there, because all of this is like I said, the snake eating its own tail. You have the CIA who trained bin Laden to. Who knows what extent, how good they trained this guy, you know? They just say he was a guy who was leading guys in the mountains and giving them ammo and all this, but when you have the CIA involved and you have a leader, they trained them in an absolute way. So, you know, who knows how, what, or why, but you do know that, you know, we all know that the head of the snake was involved and the tail of the snake has just been eaten. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It is exactly what happens all the time.
And we don't hear much about the CIA's involvement I think Reagan even had, I don't know if it was Osama bin Laden or all, but a lot of the Mujahideen from Afghanistan that he was connected with, they came to the White House and they were giving them millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
We know, as you were saying, that that's something we don't hear about in the news, how that was created. Just like they funded Noriega and Panama and all these other dictators.
Well, Noriega was a CIA agent.
Yeah.
So it's like, how does that happen, you know?
He turned, though.
Yeah, so...
He became, quote-unquote, the enemy. He was not as cooperative.
Yeah, exactly.
With the powers that be. And you know what else I really love sharing with you, too, is about the fire. And you are an amazing keeper of the sacred fire. You're a wisdom keeper of the fire. You're welcome. I've never seen anyone... You know, the spirits are so strong in ceremonies where you are that fire tender. And it's impeccable. It shows. I mean, I can really feel and see the difference. And people feel real comfortable and safe and able to go deeply within with the environment that you create before. So I'd love it if you could talk a little bit about how the fire works with you and what you learn from the element of the fire. And, you know, the fire comes from the sun and just what you've been taught and what the fire teaches you and the stones that go into it.
Well, I'd just like to say thank you for your kind words. And
oh, sure, Jesse.
And I'd like to say thank you, Dina, to one of my good friends and one of my teachers, Martine Herrera. And,
yes, Martine Herrera.
To Anne Marie Sayers and all
We've
of the it. Other...
Anne Marie's been on the program. I'll have to get Martine on, too.
And everybody else who holds, you know, ceremonies too out there in a good way, I think you about the fire, it's just, you know, so much to say about it. I can just only go back to, I guess, my first time looking at it in that way. It was at the first lodge I was at, and it was at a powwow, and it was at night, and I remember looking at the fire like that and never really knowing, you know, that I would be doing fire ever or anything of that nature. But but all my life I've always kind of had this fascination with fire. And so, but as far as, you know, as far as the connection, you know, I see it as a symbolism for the spirit inside of you, you know, and the spirit inside of you, well, the symbolism for that is creator, that is the creator that made everything, then everything that dwells in everything, that is every little particle, every atom, and you're not going to find it, you know, you're not going to find God in a lab, in a little microscope or anything like that. It's everywhere. All things that make energy, and so that energy is the energy that makes up the human soul and that gives the soul light. And from that light, you have the fire light, and also from the fire light, you have the light that sparks the life in the mother's womb that gives life to the egg, the embryo.
Beautiful, it certainly does.
And so there's so many connections of the light, you know, and.
Oh, continue. I love the way your mind just extrapolates from one thing, and you speak such truth, and it just comes easily, effortlessly.
It's just the way that I see it is that you drop a pebble in a pond, and the waves keep radiating out towards, well, that's how I see it, the creator, and it has a breakdown to us. I see, you know, you've got creator, you've got the universe, you've got the sun, you've got us, and you've got all the creatures on the earth.
Where
and you've
we
got
all
the light.
Originate.
Yeah, and you've got the light inside of us. And then from that light, we can make the light. We can make fire, or we can make light. You know, we can make the light through
and
our mouth.
And this is the truth. These are not just words.
Yeah, you know, these are just things that I've come to realize as trying to figure out my truth in my life as pertains to me, or maybe it pertains to other people, I can't say, but I can just say in my life, this is how it's become in my eyes. But, you know, and also the representation of the Lodge of the Fire, you know, you have the womb of the Earth Mother. You have the altar that say is the egg, and you have the spark of light, the mm-hmm. life that comes from the fire that goes past the altar into the lodge and goes around four times and comes out. You know, and that's mm-hmm. and so, you know, for me that's what it means to me, but it also means, like I said, the soul. And mm-hmm. and I started, you know, always in my whole life I've had experiences or heard of stories of from other cultures, of mm-hmm. whether it be in Asian cultures, of chi power, you know, the chi force in the body.
Sure.
Or of how Native Americans call it spirit, or you know,
in the center in our belly.
Absolutely. So there's all these cultures, and they all have a name for it, but they don't know exactly what it is. But it is chi power. That's how I refer to it as. And yeah. and this can be used, and the way the Native Americans use it in the Nipi is that it's used through prayer. It's to maximize your prayer. Martial artists use the chi power to maximize their body and their martial arts. If this is your chi, your soul, you can use do whatever you want in life to maximize your potential.
And Alan is an acupuncturist, and he's studied Qigong for years, so he's over there nodding his head and just itching to say something here.
I'm just in total agreement with you, and you know, I think it's really important now that we're bringing together the political knowledge and understanding with the spiritual understanding such as understanding that, you know, the difference between power over and power with, you know, the power of being in harmony with the elements and with Mother Nature and with other beings. It's a different kind of power, you know. It's a more connected power.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. It's the most high power, you know.
Yeah.
And when you're connected with that, everything falls underneath. So everything's easier to learn because you know that power.
Yes.
And, you know.
Yes.
It's more of a it really is. It's like a it's kind of I'll refer to Edgar Cayce real quick. It's like he said that that people fully won't start to realize human potential until they start to study the spirit, the soul, like any other study, like they study rocks or like they study the stars.
Mm-hmm.
The soul needs to be studied the same way and needs to be looked at that same way, and not until humans start doing that will we fully start to realize our potential and will fully start to evolve into the next evolution that we should be going into right now. But we're being, you know, dummies, I guess I would say, for lack of a better word,
yes.
into not knowing the potential of the spirit.
Well,
you know,
I want you to know something. There is a university that I'm actually going to in June called Seoul University in India, and I'll share that with you later. But they're beginning to crop up.
Definitely.
And
I do.
It's amazing. It's a more of a Hindu tradition, but I always look for those similarities. And they talk a lot about the sun in terms of the elements in the womb, learning a lot about the womb chakra. So I know what you're saying is so universal, and yet not many know this knowledge, and it's who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And it eradicates fear right away. That light, sun is number one. It's the first element.
It's divine energy, and
yes.
A lot of native traditions, as well as the Hindu tradition, that the sun is, you know, the usually the masculine divinity, but it's that holy energy, and that puts in, you know, the sunspots kind of coming into our creating solar flares, creating disturbances is in a way purification if we start to understand what's really going on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. you know, and
purification ceremony.
And you know the sun in many ways, you know, it's been looked at as a divine thing for so long because we look at ourselves so much as this independent thing on this planet, and everything is for us to consume because that's what we've been taught. But we've grown out of this planet, and we've evolved with this planet just like all the other animals. And we have minerals in our bodies that other animals have, and mm-hmm. that give us awarenesses to energy fields and to disasters if they're going to happen and things of this nature. But we're so thinned out from that that we can't sense those things as high as we can. And since we are the beings that we are, we can sense these through dreams or visions. This is how it comes to us. Animals mm-hmm. get you know, fight or flight, but we get them in advance, you know, depending on how clean the body is. And so, you know, and so in terms of speaking in that aspect, the sun is an energy source. Creator is creator, created everything, all the planets and everything, created the planets to put moods in our mm-hmm. bodies and to control us in such ways so that we can know what to pray for and how to pray for it.
And we've been wired that way naturally.
Yeah, exactly. And the sun is like, think of us as solar panels. Think of us as plants. Plants absorb sunlight in through their cells. Well, we do the same thing. We absorb this sunlight in this way, and it goes to our glandular system. And there's a way of predicting human attitudes, just like using the zodiac, and it's through the glandular system. And that's, and the only way to that those would be affected by the sun is if we're soaking in this energy as electronic dual energy. And it, you know, makes sense because it says, you know, the more healthy your diet and the more water that you drink, the more you'll be able to conduct energy through your body and receive messages.
And right now I'm looking at chocolate and popcorn. That's what I've been munching on. I wouldn't say that's healthy. I feel a twinge of guilt. There is water, though. Oh, Jesse, you've got me. Oh, dear. I just want, for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. And we always are looking for donations, and those can be mailed to FRSC POB 7811 Santa Cruz 95061. And we're speaking with musician, researcher, and firekeeper extraordinaire Jesse Sabala. And right now, I just want to play a song that I think would be real appropriate to what our discussion is. And it's one of my favorites. It's Beautiful World in Existence. Let me get that on here for one moment.
They went to parliamentarians and told them about how we are recruiting children, about how we've come to take over the world, how we've come to take over the world.
Ooh.
Well, that was Beautiful World Existence, and you're listening to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1. And we're speaking this hour with Jesse Cibola about the history, our history, and how it has really fostered negativity in our lives. And we're touching upon that and then going into ways in which we can work beyond that programming and how we envision our world. And we've also touched upon fire, the element fire, because Jesse does work as a firekeeper of the sacred fire, the Yanipi, that many of you know is the term sweat lodge. So I want to get back to him. Jesse. Jesse, hi, are you back? Jesse.
Oh, there,
hi, there you are. Okay. Thought I lost you for a moment there.
Okay. So where did we leave off at?
We left off, we were talking about at length about the sun and the chi. I wanted to maybe go back to that a bit more and its correlations and how it we would not exist without the sun. It was the first planet.
Well, about, you know, the sun, on many levels, you know, we wouldn't exist, and it's been looked at as a god and all these and different rites for a good reason. But, you know, creator is creator, created all things, but the sun, it creator made for us to receive energy, to get energy, mm-hmm. in electronic form, which is the chi energy in our body, and it fuels that energy. It fuels your soul energy, and it also fuels your glandular energy, which controls your mood, which is controlled by the planet and the sun and solar flares.
So what I hear you saying is that we are in much more control of our emotions by utilizing that energy.
Yeah, well, by
it's
knowing
there for that, knowing how to.
Yeah, exactly. By knowing how it's going to affect our body, by knowing how it's going to affect our body, and knowing, because everybody's different, you know, in aspects of everything, eating diets and everything, you know, everybody's different to the person. So, you know, with sun, using sun energy, you know, it can be a hard thing to handle or to grasp, to understand, unless you have lived in it, you know, and I can only speak from my experience, but I can say that I've been in situations of extreme, malnourishment on things, haven't taken care of myself in certain ways, on hikes maybe or some things, and this is on a different level that the sun has helped me. I have been able to use the sun in those ways to help to give me more energy to move forward when it was lacking in other ways. This is the way that prayer could be used also, you know, to keep moving forward is the same.
Yes. I think of Sundance. To survive without food and water for 4 days.
Exactly.
You rely on the power of prayer and going beyond that. It's the sun.
The power of your spirit. Your spirit,
yeah,
at that time, the spirit is glowing, you know. It's at a maximum point almost and being magnified by the sun out there. So, you know, I hear a lot of, you know, I've heard a lot of different stories, but, you know, with the sun, it's very much like that, and I was very intrigued when I first heard that it affects our glandular system and the moods of our body, you know, that much. So we are very much controlled by the sun. I mean, you see when it's foggy, you don't see many people out doing much.
No.
They don't feel active. They feel really out and down, and they don't realize it, you know. They think it's this or that, but they're not paying attention to the things. You know, they're not paying attention to their connection with nature and how, you know, on days when the sun's not there, maybe to avoid this, you should be knowing that you should be moving with more energy on that day. You should get up and be more forceful towards yourself to do things instead of being the same as it was, as if it was sunny, you know. you know, there's just ways to, you know, there's balance. It's about the balance, you know, and there's ways to balance out those things.
Those elements within us, for sure.
Yeah.
And I often feel, well, a little twinge of sadness when I wake up and see dreariness and clouds day after day, and I remember, but the sun still shines behind them, and just that thought in and of itself is a little bit of energy, and it's true, because that's what's happening inside of me. It's coloring my perspective on something.
And that's another thing that has helped me too, is that, you know, on those days the sun isn't there and I'm doing this thing, that's when I started looking outward towards outward, I'm meaning in front of me and around me, not up where the sun is, but up and around me and down to the Mother Earth and to all of the things around me, to trees or to anything, because that's all the same energy.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the same energy. It is. Everything's created out of the same energy source. So everything is the same energy. You can look at everything and take and draw that same energy to that same appreciation.
And you know what's interesting? I've often felt that very strongly when I'm sitting with the fire for a period of time, be it a campfire, before a ceremony, or even looking at a candle. It subtly works to bring that awareness.
Yeah, it brings in that sacred,
percolates up.
Yeah, it brings in that sacred silence inside of yourself. You know, it brings your focus, your true. Yeah, it takes you straight to the center almost immediately if you look right at it.
Yeah,
know,
there's
fire.
A harmonizing effect of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, it's because it's a part, you know. It's a part of you. There's a fire inside of everybody that's there, and it's your soul, and I can't really explain it. I haven't talked with many other people who do fire, and I'm not a great person by any means. I just have been inspired for only a couple of years. I know people who've been doing it for a lot longer than me and who've done a lot more. And so I'm just I'm just still learning, still scratching the surface. And I'm just only, you know, sharing my experiences, you know, because I can just say that once, you know, I did start doing fire, that all this, you know, I'd be, and in different levels and in different places, you know, I started having moments of enlightenment, of true enlightenment, of what is described in Buddhism as all these things, you know what I mean, of just where everything that you're looking at the moment, and the feeling in your body and how everything feels and your perception of everything is at a perfectness. Even though if the average person came by and looked at your surroundings that you were at, they would say they're imperfect. You know what I mean? But it's, you know, and the only way I see that, that kind of focuses on that on an everyday basis is the Lakota way, is the, you know, is the Anipi, because it constantly is causing enlightenment and people who come in and out of it all the time. It's constantly enlightened with something about themselves, about the Earth Mother, about the universe, about something. But there's something there for, you know, it is there.
It's such a natural intelligence. Mm-hmm. If you open your heart to it.
Yeah, you know, it kind of reminds me.
You can't just look at it as something that can burn you or have it. It's just a fire. It is the sacred fire. And they're all sacred fires.
Yeah, every fire that is, that every fire that's there, you know, just like all the water, just like the wind, just like the earth, it's all, and it's like the center, you know, it's like the sun.
The elements. Well, we're going. We're going to have to wrap it up pretty soon, but I want our listeners to know that you're going to be one of our new co-hosts in a couple of weeks. So we'll be hearing a lot more from Jesse, and I know he'll be playing his music as well, which I look forward to hearing live in the studio.
I look forward to that.
Both Alan and I are real excited about you coming on with us.
Yeah, I'm very excited too. It'd be a good experience for me.
Yeah, well, you know, you just have so much to offer, particularly in these times.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you. I'm sorry.
How much time do we have left?
We have about, oh,
about 5 minutes. Yeah.
Oh, you are, oh, good. We have 5 minutes. I thought it was less. We have 5 minutes.
Do you mind if I share a quick little thing with you?
Not at all.
Okay, I just have a quick little thing here. This goes to, you know, how the powers that be, they keep wanting to discredit the fact that people lived in North America and in South America before the Bering Strait, and that, you know, they're just trying to, they keep trying to find a new way to try to say that, you know, Europeans were here before any other culture so that they can have rights to the land and all this stuff. So they keep coming up with all of these things to try to, you know, try to discredit the fact that people were living here, and even scientists who come out and archaeologists who come out with findings, they hide them from people. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, you know, there's a finding because the Bering Strait theory goes back to, what, 10,000 to 12,000 years, and that's saying that people came through the Bering Strait through from Asia across down to here, down through California. Well, they found in 1880 at Table Mountain, J.D. Whitney found 55 million-year-old stone tools, ladles, and bowls, etc. You know, much older than the Bering Strait, which is 12,000 years old. And then let's see, right here is they found 250,000-year-old sophisticated stone tools near Puebla, Mexico. So that's 250,000 years old in Mexico, and then 32,000-year-old artifacts in the Yukon, 70,000-year-old artifacts in New York. Let's see, 28,000-year-old artifacts in Nevada, and so on and so forth. So, you know, they just keep on saying this, and it's true. People did come to the Bering Strait, but they didn't come and populate this land over here. People from Asia were coming over here, you know, before Europe was coming over here. You know,
oh, definitely. There's a major correlation between Han Chinese culture and the Mayan, ancient Mayan culture. There is a lot of interchange happening.
Yeah. And you know, just like that, you know, there's a scientist, he's following bloodlines, and you know, there is some Pueblo cultures who did come from through the Bering Strait, and also some Aztec and some other North American tribes through the Midwest right there. They did come through there, and like, you know, some California tribes, but there were people here long before, because, you know, there's like you said, right now, there is a tribe in South America that looks Asian in descent, and no one else looks like them. But there's also the South Americans who look completely different in body proportions and everything than Mexicans do. Mm-hmm. You know, or Mexicas, and totally different than North Americans do. So it's like, you know, did they come from the Bering Strait if all the people down on the bottom of South America all look like this, and if all these people look like this, but just this little speckle of tribes look all the same. But yeah, so I just want to share that little piece there.
And that's major, and there are many other discoveries just waiting to be rediscovered that are presently hidden.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, and we look forward to getting to hear more and
having you on a regular basis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
This is wonderful.
Appreciate the opportunity and the good words and the openness to conversation.
Yeah. It's easy with you.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, we'll have in between... we have coming
Thank
up
you, Jesse.
William Domhoff, who has a website, Who Rules America. He's a professor at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and he will be with us in a bit. In the meantime, we will have some music from David Rovix. This is also south of the border, going a little back to Central America, and a lot of us who remember the 1980s had a lot of memories of the revolution in Nicaragua.
There we go. And who's our next guest, Alan? Do you want to say a little bit about him?
William Domhoff. We'll have him on in a few minutes.
And what's he going to be speaking about, and who is he?
I believe he's an economics professor at UCSC, and we'll have that on momentarily.
A radical economist, folks. Stay tuned. He'll be on in about 5 minutes. Thank you.
After morning chores, while the weather's still cool, see the little ones hurry off to school. Excitement on their faces, running through the weeds. Praise this revolution, for now they can learn to read. You've got to praise this revolution, for now they learn to read. I Your time has come, may your future shine like the eyes of your young. You see the young boys are running from base to base, hearts pumping, they're breathing heavy, never seeming to slow the pace. Smiles on their faces as one breaks away. Praise this revolution, for now there's some time to play. You've got to praise this revolution, for now there's time to play. Dying Nicaragua, your time has come, may your future shine like the eyes of your laughing young girls that gather firewood to take back home where mama cooks the food. Smiles on their faces, got no shoes on their feet. Praise this revolution, now there's more to eat. You've got to praise this revolution. Dying Nicaragua, your time has come, may your future shine like the eyes of your young. Dying Nicaragua, your time has come, may your future shine.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Yeah, ma'am.
This is Radio Free Santa Cruz, and we have a very special guest with us, William Domhoff from, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, but from, you're a professor at University of California at Santa Cruz, correct?
Right. I'm a retired professor from UC Santa Cruz.
And, okay, but What department were you in? You were in.
I was in mostly in sociology.
Uh huh. But do you have a website? Who Rules America? Is it .org?
WhoRulesAmerica.net.
.net. Okay.
And up there we have everything that I and my friends have to say about most things. But no, seriously, we do cover wealth, income, power, connections to government, corporate interlocks, social change, some history stuff. So, yeah, we have a lot of stuff up there.
Well, it's definitely a subject that most of the population really needs to learn about. As we've been pretty duped. The mainstream media has not been giving us the real scoop. So I look forward to that, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about your history at the university. I guess you taught for quite a number of years, and then you've had written several books, correct?
Right. I came here, and I was lucky, and I got to come here when it opened in the fall of 1965.
Oh, at the very beginning.
Yeah, I've taught there ever since. Still teach now and then. Been a great run for me. I feel very lucky. But I also had the chance to take an early retirement when the university pension fund was in a little stronger position many years ago. And so the second greatest thing that ever happened in my career after coming to Santa Cruz was being able to retire early, which meant that I basically just taught one quarter and had more time for students and for research and didn't have to be involved in administrative stuff and hiring people and evaluating people, and just made it a carefree existence. Very grateful, as I said. And yeah, I had the opportunity to write a lot of things. And you know, it's funny, part of it was because of the 60s, meaning in the 60s, the work-study students, there was more generous work-study money, and the chancellor had said the students have to learn something when they do work-study. So that sent them all in the direction of professors. Whereas later on, when the university got tighter and tighter on money, they would put the students to work on the loading dock or sitting in the library or doing whatever and forget about, you know, they learned something. But at one point, I'd have five or six researchers at a time. They were all great students and great people, and they helped me a lot. So it was like I'd had grants. But as you can imagine, studying the power structure, I didn't figure there was much chance I would get any grants from the big foundations that are in fact run by the owners and managers of large corporations, and they give money strategically for their interest to fund the institutes and think tanks that they think will be useful to them.
But
you're doing something frivolous or something they don't like, they're not going to fund you.
But you did receive some grants or some?
I tell you, I never applied.
Uh-huh.
I was able to get university support, and particularly with the work-study students for a long time into the 70s, and I'd get a little academic senate research grant to supplement it, and away I'd go. So, yeah, I did a lot of books. I started in 1967 with a book called Who Rules America, which I've updated several times, but I had the powers that be, fat cats and Democrats, the you name it, power elite in the state. I tried to hit all the angles on power nationally and locally, and I can say that I wrote, it's a very academic book, but one of my former students and I wrote a book called The Leftmost City, Power and Progressive Politics in Santa Cruz, which was about the years from, basically about the years from 1970 to 1995,
mm-hmm.
and told about the fact that very rare that neighborhood environmental student coalition has been able to take over any city in the country, even ones with big universities. But for a unique set of reasons, including how liberal the UC student body was and how politically attentive it became and active, neighborhoods actually triumphed over the developers and landowners in Santa Cruz for a lot of years.
And the reason it's a livable place now, the reason there's a lot of things that are decent that are taken for granted, is because these activists worked really hard throughout the 70s, and then they won office in 79, and then for two seats, then won two more in 81, and then they ran the city ever since. But they were constantly challenged in 83 and 85 and 87 with really scurrilous campaigns, calling them every name in the book, of course, money coming in from the outside, expert conservative consultants from Santa Monica, the whole nine yards. So we've written about local power, and we've written about national power.
Great. Well, I'll take this a moment here to introduce my co-host, Janaea, who's here.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
And this is, we're talking with William Domhoff. This is Radio Free Santa Cruz. I'm Alan, and we're going to spend this hour talking about basically the social and wealth inequity of both the country. And it's great to hear. I didn't realize you had so much connection with the local history and economy. I know in the 90s I was active struggling against major development.
Well, I don't want to pretend I was any activist. I was sympathetic and, you know,
supportive.
Donate or give money, but or sign, you know, petitions. But there's a lot of amazing students and graduates of Santa Cruz and activist faculty and downtown neighbors that were terrific. Just were tremendous. They're all just about gone from the scene now.
Mm-hmm.
John Laird is still around, and he was on the city council a few times in the 80s, and then mm-hmm. went on, of course, to the state government. But mm-hmm. it's a gone era now, and most people don't know about it. And I would say to younger people out there, that's one place where I sure wouldn't believe the slant that's in the Sentinel about the past, because they're constantly mm-hmm. saying, oh, these guys wouldn't allow growth, they wouldn't do this, they wouldn't do that. So they're trying to blame whatever troubles Santa Cruz has on the triumph of progressives, when in fact what has happened in every city in America is because anti-government ideologues and their financial backers have taken over, they've cut the taxes on everybody that's well-to-do, and they've starved all these cities and, of course, mm-hmm. the federal government. And that's why nothing grows, and that's why nothing happens. There's mm-hmm. no money out there to come into Santa Cruz. They also, the big businesses, pushed very hard for the laws that are called free trade. But what they are is a license to go to low-wage countries and produce goods and then ship them back into the United States. And that, of course, undercut jobs like crazy. So between 1995, say, and I think it was 2005, 2006, Santa Cruz County lost, I think it was 1,500 jobs. Not mm-hmm. obviously not in giant factories, but, you know, 200 here, 400 there, 300 there, going to low-wage countries.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's hurt Santa Cruz, not the wonderful progressives that ran it.
Right, and it seems like there's been a gentrification process that I've seen over the years, too, that it's a beautiful place, so people with money come here, and it's harder and harder for those of us that are, you know, just trying to get by day to day.
Yeah, and that is the irony of it, is that you make a place attractive,
mm-hmm.
and then people want to live there, and they bid up the price. And that wasn't foreseen, mm-hmm. you know, in the 70s and even the 80s. Now, you know, there started to be commuters over the Silicon Valley, but many of them were locals that were commuting over there. And then, you know, in the last 20 or 25 years, it's been the case, as you say, that more well-to-do people have come over the hill to Santa Cruz, partly because it was a little cheaper here than Silicon Valley for a while. But, not tenderly, I remember the day, but it used to be there weren't all those fancy houses on Westcliff.
Mm-hmm.
They were, much more modest, and they've been gradually replaced or, you know, built rebuilt and made bigger. So there is that issue that that comes up. But, you know, that also gives me a chance, Alan, to deal with another false statement that's made about Santa Cruz and other livable cities, and that is they say, well, the environmentalists made it so it was too expensive to build houses. But that's not true. One of my sociology friends did a study where he compared counties with pretty strict environmental laws versus counties like San Bernardino that, you know, let it all hang out in Riverside, where you can pretty much build, and the prices track each other. They parallel a lot. And so it's just not true, and it's been shown before. The other thing that's interesting but sad, a sad experiment in terms of this current housing bust, decline in prices. Everybody said in Santa Cruz, well, Santa Cruz is beautiful, it's desirable, housing prices will never go down. In fact, they said that in Seattle and San Francisco and San Diego and Atlanta and on and on. And in fact, housing prices have gone down everywhere, including Santa Cruz. So we're part of this big national economy, which is dominated by big corporations who bring in their products from low-wage countries. And in that kind of tension, the most often when there's tension, people kind of revert to their basics. And our basics involve scrimping and saving, and we think of the government wrongly as having a budget like our household budget. And so the conservatives have demonized deficit spending and a small amount of inflation. They've all been demonized, but the sad truth is that's what we need. We need a lot of government spending to keep this big complex system going. But they won't allow it, and they're very successful, of course, in winning elections because they claim that the other side, the liberal labor left environmentalist social movement side, is lazy and shiftless and just wants to spend money. So they've got quite a rap out. They also use racial and religious appeals to try to stir up white fear and resentment. And the result has been the Congress we have, and therefore we can't deal with what is basically a pretty simple problem where we should run deficits and raise taxes on more well-to-do people. If, well, you know, if we had our taxes just back where they were when George Bush Jr. took over, we'd have enough money. And, you know, nobody was, no poor, no rich people were skimping in 1980 before Reagan really cut their taxes.
Well, let's take things a step further back into Proposition 13, I think. Was that in the 70s where...
Right, 1978, yeah.
Yeah.
So the conservatives always want to cut taxes. They say they believe in balanced budgets. At some level, they do. But right now, if you were to cut taxes more, especially on the well-to-do, and you were cut government spending, in fact, you would drive the country even create more unemployment, which then means you need more payments for Medicaid, you need more unemployment insurance, and their response to that would be, well, we'll just cut the size of unemployment, we'll cut the size of disability benefits, which of course reduces consumer spending even further.
Well,
so
it's
a very self-destructive path for the economy. It's very sad because they believe that's, quote, radical or socialist, when in fact the people that developed those understandings were the people that saved the free enterprise system, as it's called, in the 1930s. Incidentally, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to point out that I don't remember the exact statistics, but in the 70s, California had one of the top-rated educational systems, I think, in the top three, and now it's in the bottom three of the 50 states that we have and we've just seen the teachers out protesting about just how dismal it's gotten. So, I mean, maybe...
Oh, it's just tragic. It's tragic because it's unnecessary. when what happened was in the 1970s is that because of the inflation and houses were, you know, the value of your house went up. Now, that was good if you were going to sell your house, but if you were kind of in the middle and not making, getting big gains in income, your property taxes went up. Mm-hmm. But not so huge, really, that would destroy anybody. But, again, conservatives jumped on the increase in property taxes, and that's how it passed Proposition 13. Mm-hmm. But here the tragic thing was, and I remember it well, there was a choice point, and Jerry Brown was the governor, and he had a $5 billion surplus. That's what the budget in Sacramento had spent, $5 billion sitting in the bank. Mm-hmm. And the liberals told him, you better start spending that stuff so people feel they're getting their money's worth from government. Mm-hmm. Start to, you know, better parks, better roads, more recreation, more this, and, you know, help create jobs with social services that people really appreciate. And Jerry Brown hesitated because he ain't no liberal, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And it gave the conservatives a chance to jump in and say, look, if they got $5 billion up there, they can send some of that to the cities. Let's cut our property taxes. And that law was so harsh that it's destroyed the cities, the schools, everything.
You know,
and yet there's money all over the place in California.
And Professor, this is Janaea speaking, and it seems like you've brilliantly summarized the ways in which the wealthy elite and financiers and corporations have basically absconded with our system of democracy and control now just about every aspect of our lives, our politics, our the educational system, as Alan was saying, our spirituality. There are so many ways they've impacted our lives. How do you see this turning around? What factors?
Well,
need to
you
be
know,
in
that's
place?
A really, really, really hard question, and
yeah.
I've actually thought about it a lot
so
and wrote about it, and nobody that would like to see it more equal quite agrees with me on how mm-hmm. to do it. And
but just starting
and nobody that,
dialogue.
That wants to change things. You get 10 people in the room that like to see more equality, and they can't agree on what to do. And what that's come to tell me is that that there's probably no one way that would mm-hmm. work very easily, or we would come to more agreement. Mm-hmm. In 2006, when I brought out a new edition of Who Rules America, I said very briefly that the conservatives, what I called the corporate conservative coalition, was in such complete charge of America.
Yes.
There was no countervailing force, and the only thing that could possibly change things was if the Iraq war went really sour, mm-hmm. or if they created a disaster in the economy. And of course, both of those things I wasn't predicting by any means.
Sure.
But that's what happened. Americans turned against the Iraq war. And nobody really quite saw it coming, maybe a few pollsters. But in 2006, to most people's shock, for the first time in a long time, the people that call themselves independent voted basically 60% to 39% for Democrats for Congress. And the Democrats took over Congress again. And although, you know, they're not very liberal by any stretch of the imagination, they stopped some of the right-wing destruction of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2008, we had a similar thing. We had a meltdown of the economy in middle September.
Mm-hmm.
And we're only now, we knew it was bad at the time, but only recently are we really getting the full picture that even the biggest banks, and everybody's heard of Goldman Sachs by now, but even those banks, those were then called investment banks, they were in such trouble. This always amazes me.
Yeah.
Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, two of the five biggest financial houses in the country, They apply to the government on Thursday or Friday of the week to be made into commercial banks, which means the government will guarantee up to whatever, $200,000 you have in the bank or whatever it is. But the point is, Monday morning, they were commercial banks. Mm. That's how much trouble they were in. And Goldman Sachs, you know, lots of those guys should be prosecuted. That probably won't be. In any case, the point is...
Well, they rule America, correct?
It's a true syndicate.
They're the rulers.
Yeah. Yep. And any rate, the point is that the war, the Iraqi war, and then the meltdown in September of 2008 put the Democrats, you know, back in charge and put a Democrat in the White House. But it's still the case that the Republicans have a strong veto power. We don't have really majority rule in the United States. We have, you see, the super majority. Just like in California, you know, you've got to have, what is it, two-thirds of the vote to in the state assembly and the state senate to pass the budget. So a handful of very conservative Republicans from San Diego and L.A. suburbs and from highly rural counties, they can stop the budget. They can stop you from raising taxes. Except, of course, if you want to raise very regressive taxes like, you know, on sales.
Yeah.
Then, you know, which then hurts lower-income people. So we're really trapped. If I really thought I had really great ideas and insight and was confident I was right, I'd be running around the country yelling and screaming, hey, please listen to me. But I guess I don't have that perspective. And anybody that's very liberal is in the minority anyhow. In other words, you know, and if you take these polls, I think they're pretty accurate on this. You ask people how liberal they are, and all. You know, and only 20% of Americans would say they're liberal, and that usually includes all of leftists, too, of course. So, you're heavily outnumbered. You've got to win the middle. You've got to, you know, somehow there are a lot of people that are, you know, not totally anti-government in their ideology. See, the problem is the other side has such a demonization of government.
Yes.
That's reinforced constantly, as you say, by corporations. Mm-hmm. There's such a fear of government, even though we elect the people, and even though it's mostly, as one commentator puts it, our government in Washington is mostly an insurance company that happens to have an army. And that's where all the money goes, to Social Security, which we paid into, of course. And then it goes to Medicare and Medicaid. And then it goes to defense.
The
Disease Control Center and the Agricultural Inspection Centers and the research for science, that's all a tiny part of the budget. Foreign aid is 1 or 2% of the budget. You know, it's 70-80% defense,
Social Security, military,
Medicare, Medicaid, and
Homeland Security.
But yet people don't trust it, even though it does well by them. Here's the thing. You ask people, is the government any good? And they say no. They say, when did you deal with the government lately? And I say, well, I get Social Security checks. How does that go? Oh, perfect. That part's perfect.
I know it.
You ask another person, how's Medicare? Well, it's good for me. And you ask a low-income person, is Medicaid paying? And it's mostly paying.
They're not making the connections, and the media isn't giving them the opportunities to make those connections. They're making it more confusing and simplistic. And I love the way you've given us a history.
If you go out and try to talk to people, though, and say, here's why I think my view is best, and you're directly face-to-face with them, they don't like your views. So, I mean, it's not just the media. People have... It's kind of hard to abstract to say that the government is not like a household, because you think it should balance its budget and never run a deficit. And it's hard to then convince somebody without, you know, making a pretty academic argument like about history, that where we know what happened when the budgets were cut and then the Depression. Like in 1937, Roosevelt balanced the budget. A lot of his advisors said, look, the economy's recovered. It was recovering. They said, you can now balance the budget and it'll all take care of itself. And within 3 or 4 months, the economy plunged again.
Mm.
Something I happen to be studying right now, so that's why I got it on my mind.
Interesting.
And by God, there was big tensions within his government. And finally, after he read all the various arguments and talked to the people, he started government spending again. So the government, so the economy started to improve a little bit. But here's the amazing thing. The only thing that saved America from the constant depression we're now in, mm-hmm. if we jump back to the 30s, only thing that saved it was a huge deficit spending for World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It put everybody to work. It's like priming a pump in a well. So you pump, pump, pump. The government gets everybody working. They have money. They're spending like crazy. Now people can buy cars mm-hmm. and washing machines and houses, and that puts real estate guys to work. And then everybody can pay taxes. And then, lo and behold, the government can pay off its debt.
But it's a difference.
Economy, go ahead.
It's a different situation now with these wars, high-tech wars they're fighting, in Asia, because they're not benefiting. They're benefiting a few corporations and
right.
individuals. They're right. not benefiting the vast majority of the population.
It's not priming the pump.
Right. You're right. That is true. And also the percentage, even though I said the percentage was very high of government spendings on defense, when you look at how huge our economy now is, defense spending is actually a smaller percentage of our gross domestic product, GDP, than it was, say, for the Korean War or the Vietnam War, certainly for World War II. So it's really hard to get across that idea of deficit spending to prime the pump and get the economy moving again.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to get that across to people. They think, and you're automatically a socialist and so on. But here's the irony, is this, that it's really hard. The socialists say, well, we've got to have a planned economy. But that turns out to be really, really hard to do. And China couldn't do it. Cuba couldn't do it. The Soviet Union couldn't do it. They all failed. Forget that, they were tyrannies. The point is they couldn't make their economies work. And so you have to have a considerable degree of a market and mm-hmm. private enterprise, because you don't have enough information to plan from the center.
Exactly.
So the left has to allow for a little market, and the center has to understand that government spending is not evil. And
that combination
might work.
What we have currently is a corporate, I guess we'd even call it technically fascism, because you've got the marriage of corporate power with military power, but
yeah.
you have a system where all the regulation's been stripped beyond, I think,
right.
we're being set back like almost a century to, getting rid of labor, and what was
right.
it, the Glass-Steagall Act? What was that,
yeah.
the act
well,
that
was an act
protections
that...
that were in place.
There was an act in 1933, and then it was strengthened in 1934, in which they said, look, you finance companies, what we'd call them today, you big financial enterprises, you either have to be a commercial bank, which means you take in deposits like Comerica or Bank of America, and then lend it out to individuals, or you have to be what's called an investment bank, where you sell a company's stock, or you lend big companies only money, and you're playing with an investment bank. You're dealing with your own big sums of money. The bankers basically, this is the contradiction of it all. The bankers hated it. They hated that system, and yet it made for a very stable banking system for a long time. But over the last
30, 40 years,
they chipped away at it. Mm-hmm. They just take little pieces out, little pieces out. And then finally, in 1999, they effectively did away with the act you're referring mm-hmm. to, called Glass-Steagall. And that made it so these big commercial banks could become investment banks, and the investment banks started to move on over into taking deposits. And they once again screwed up. So mm-hmm. here's the bigger thing about power. Here is, what almost gets to the profound, and that is when people get to be powerful, when they're the king of the mountain, whether it's the king of Spain in the past or a king of a corporation, they lose all perspective. You know, and we know that. We say he's, you know, too big for his britches, he's a hot dog, he's full of himself. And there's lots of studies in psych, fascinating studies in social psych. As soon as people get a little power over others, it distorts their thinking. It just distorts it. And they don't listen as carefully. They don't see individuals. They just see generalities.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're running a big corporation, you're just looking at, you know, all the balance sheets and how to cut costs. And so if you move your if you move the factory to a third world country that's low wage, you don't even think about the individuals that you've hurt in the United States. If you did, you might get guilty. So you live in your own separate enclave, so you don't have to see those people. You have you hire personnel managers to see them, so you don't have to see them, and so you become very impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
And the final point is, you do then screw up. And one of my colleagues in sociology, and another at Berkeley, a really fine sociologist, he used to say the one thing about you can count on, and this goes back to the earlier point in question, if ultra-conservatives get truly and fully in control of the government and the economy, they will really mess it up. They will really do stuff that's wrong, because they have no they lose all perspective. Power has to be checked. What's the example? George Bush, coming out of Texas, actually fought. He could fight an easy war in Iraq. No war is easy, and we're now seeing that in Libya.
Mm-hmm.
No war is easy. You don't lightly fight wars, and yet he did. And the same way with the economy. This economy, it's like a car with no driver. It gyrates all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to be attentive to it, because it'll go off the road. It can get into disastrous depressions. Our economy can spiral down and down and down and not come out of it.
Well, it's gone down pretty far already.
Yeah, but still, you see, the thing is, if you look out there, 80, 90, 85% of people probably figure they're working at least some. And what human beings do is we tend to adjust to our situation, especially when we're lower in the power structure, we're lower in the pecking order.
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, they put you down to three-fourths time. Okay, you can still enjoy your music. You can still practice your skill. You can still be with your loved ones. You can still support those people that need you. You can still live a very compelling, enjoyable, although constricted, everyday life.
Lowered expectations.
So we keep trimming down. Now, I'm not in any way overlooking the horrible situation that always bothers me, of the 10-15% that don't have jobs when they want them and need them and could do that.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, as long as those other 80-85% are working, the horrible truth is that they're not very worried most days about the other 15 or even 20%. And sadly, there's an ideology, and this is the bad part of a liberal ideology, it's not very cooperative. It's an individual ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And if a person's gotten rich, they tend to say, look, I worked hard. Let these guys work hard. Why aren't they working? They should pick them. They should sacrifice.
And the reality is they're working even harder usually.
Yeah, that's true. So there's a tremendous way in which is a famous book from the past, a beautiful book from right around 1970 or so, is called Blaming the Victim. And what happens in our society, you're born poor, you're malnourished, there's tension, the teachers look down upon you, and then lo and behold, you don't behave in school one day. Or you don't pay enough attention because you're hungry. And then they say you're not a hard trier. In other words, they blame the victims. The victims of the system are seen as culprits by those that are it's a game of winners and losers. Look at what happened in the mortgage market. All of these big companies, Countrywide and all the rest, they enticed people into either buying a house or take out a second mortgage. They went often to low-income people. They went to people that couldn't afford it, and they said, look, we'll sell you a house with no money down. It's going to go up in value over the next 2 years, and soon you'll be you'll be able to afford the payments that we're going to you're going to have to pay in 2 years. They entice those people, and yet when you read the newspaper, they say, "Look, if those people's fault, those people that are underwater on their mortgage, it's their fault. They were greedy. They were greedy, and they tried to have more than they deserve, and they should have worked harder first." But yet, there was all these enticements around them by, you know, ads, by salesmen, by people calling on the phone. And they look around and they see that housing values have doubled. They see you buy a condo in Las Vegas and 2 years later it's worth double. They see all that and they get caught up in the mentality. And they are victims. But that's not how the well-to-do people see it. They do not see them as victims. They see them as people that are morally lacking. Mm-hmm. And so they won't have any sympathy mm-hmm. for their fellow human beings. And that's, mm-hmm. you see, where I think people that call themselves liberals or radicals differ so considerably from those who are centrist or apolitical or highly conservative. They say, wait, I think these people got some tough breaks. They were born poor. Yeah. They didn't get good schooling. They've had, you know, bad nutrition at one point. There's much more empathy.
Yeah, much more compassion.
And there's no empathy on the part of conservatives. To the degree there is, they want to give through what they call voluntary. You know, have you go to the Salvation Army or the Second Harvest, or, you know, they'll give money to that sometime. But it's meager. And they feel it's good to be meager because that'll force people to work. If we fed them too well, they wouldn't work.
And
so
it's
they
also
really
a tax write-off.
People are lazy. The what?
It's also a tax write-off often.
Well. Also, I'd like to bring up, I'm sure you're familiar with the economist Richard Wolff. I was listening to him pointing out that in the 70s, corporations, like I guess if they made over a million, or wealthy people who made over $1 million, they paid about 91% in taxes, and that's gone down to less than 35% at the most. And obviously we see the situation where these top five oil companies are getting subsidies and making record profits. And as they raise gas prices, we're being presented by the conservatives with, well, we have to have offshore drilling. So they're using it. They use everything to their own benefit as they're making huge profits. Then
they have the total upper hand. You see, like in California, once you started cutting the taxes, then the University of California or all the state colleges, they didn't have enough money. So they had to start raising tuition, or you have to go to the rich people hat in hand. You beg them. You have an office called University Relations that goes out and begs rich people for money. That's the situation the universities are in now. But they love it. I mean, they, meaning well-to-do people, they come around and they say, oh, would you be interested in endowing a research project on the stars? Or, hey, no, I'm not interested in the stars. How about, would you be interested in endowing a marine biology project? We're going to save the dolphins. Oh, that sounds fun. I'll give you $1 million for that. But you see the power it gives them.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, if I endow a medical school, they put my name, Joe Smith Medical School, on it. So it becomes this amazing egalitarian system, which constantly lets you know where your place is. Mm-hmm. It constantly shows you where you are in the pecking order. And there's all kinds of research that shows that as you go down the pecking order, you have more stress. And as you have more stress, you're more likely to get all kinds of psychological and physiological illnesses and die younger. And it's not even about even enough food. It's about having no power, about not being respected, about not... Human beings do have a need to feel productive,
mm-hmm.
contrary to those that say some people are lazy. People have a need to have effectiveness. They want to be effective, whether it's pleasing people through beautiful music, drawing beautiful pictures that make people happy, performing beautifully in a sports event, saving dolphins, anything like that where we can feel effective is what makes us human. And that all gets cut back once you have a power hierarchy, and it just distorts everybody, including the people on the top. As I say, they lose all perspective, but they have the rest of the people subjugated.
Well, that brings us to, again, you were saying, well, what is the solution? I mean, I've always believed that we need a revolution, and obviously a violent revolution isn't really both either a moral or a practical option. But, you know, nonviolent revolution is, you know, such as we saw in Egypt. I mean, things were probably more extreme in some ways, but we see in Madison that people were, you know, pushed to the point, and they have a history of progressive politics there. So I'm wondering, you know, here in California, particularly the Bay Area, we've had a history of progressive politics, and I wonder if we can't, if people start to realize, as you said, I think we're suffering. The biggest problem is the sense of powerlessness and people being disconnected, that we don't know how to join together. Such as I heard a lot from, you know, listening to the protests in Madison, that people, one of the biggest things is people coming together and finding each other in the community that developed in that, as well as the political.
Here's a brutal thing about that. Most of those people in Wisconsin are of one racial background. What does that mean? It means that people are suspicious of others. There's tensions between people of different ethnicities and races. And therefore, they can't take that first step very easily. They can't find that common denominator. Now, sometimes they
divide and conquer.
Find it in a war. During World War II, when the army had to call on everybody, the military, the defense, they had to call on black soldiers. Now, they kept black soldiers behind the lines as much as they could. I think they sensed that letting them fight would make them feel part of things, and they would owe it to them and so on. And in some key battles in Europe, when the Germans made a comeback, right at what was called the Battle of the Bulge, they had to move the black troops forward, and they performed heroically. And I think out of that came a sense for African-Americans, including the migration northward, that they should assert themselves. And they came home from the war, and there were a lot of tensions as the white Americans in the South tried to resubjugate them. It then led to a brilliant, most powerful movement of its kind that America ever saw, which was the Civil Rights Movement, which was a movement of, as you're saying, what I would call strategic nonviolence.
And Martin Luther King was certainly an amazing, I think when he was assassinated, he was going to come out with a major program, movement against poverty. So that was...
Well, he was. Look, he was anti-war. He was had an anti-poverty campaign. But when he went in those directions, he lost a lot of his liberal supporters and some of the white supporters. So Martin Luther King, pretty shortly after his assassination, was disregarded by a numerous people, and you can see that with the way in which a man I also respect greatly, but Malcolm X, who never was really a leader of any large-scale change, but people saw him as more viable. And I had black colleagues who many years later told me, you know, I had come to appreciate Martin Luther King Jr. even more than I did. He was a brilliant leader, but the point about you're saying in the Bay Area there's a lot of progressives. Thing about strategic nonviolence is you have to find a particular point that really disrupts the everyday lives of those who run the show.
Well, okay, let me ask you
let me just say about the South. In the South, they were able, by sitting in the lunch counters, by riding buses, by marching in streets, they've stopped business from happening. They've overfilled the jails. They made the government too expensive to run. And they did strike concern to things things would not go on unless there were changes. It's hard to bring that about. The irony is that the strategic nonviolence was then perfected by a set of Americans later on, say in the 70s and the 80s, a man named Gene Sharp, but others, and they perfected strategic nonviolence. But here's what I think something you got to know about the history of the United States left in recent years. People really did turn away from that. In other words, they didn't say, yes, I practice strategic nonviolence. The implication was that someday there would be a violent revolution, and that didn't help any as far as reaching mainstream America.
Right.
But the further irony of it is these people who perfected the use of nonviolence in America, it's their work that's being used in Egypt and these other countries in Eastern Europe.
Right.
They've been to training institutes with these Americans that worked on strategic nonviolence. But yet it just was looked down upon for the last 20, 30 years. And that's a major, major problem. You have to say to yourself, what is the strategic nonviolent thing that we can do that will, in effect, disrupt the system in a way that will also bring sympathy to us from the middle? And, you know, I don't know whether that's through everybody that's underwater on mortgages. If they were to stop paying their mortgage
the next
2 years and then go rent a house, they would sink the system.
Well, that's what...
They haven't been able to organize the people to do that.
Exactly. And that's what I was going to ask you. We need to wrap up. We've only got a few minutes left. Yeah. We have to end in about 5 minutes.
Okay.
But I've always thought that tax resistance, if it were in an organized way where, you know, hundreds of thousands or, you know, a few million people refused their taxes and put it into an alternative fund or whatever, used it for the community, if people could do that all together, that would be extremely effective in conjunction with other nonviolent resistance.
I just don't know, Alan. As you say, the trick is to get lots of people doing it. And whether they would do that, or the government would just go and borrow for a year or two and sort of wait you out. The most effective nonviolence have been sit-down strikes or sit-ins. That is, it used to be in the 30s, they sat down in a factory. That was really effective, because then you couldn't bring in strike breakers. But it was ruled unconstitutional. The sit-ins were tremendously effective. So it's got to be something that more disrupts the everyday life, but doesn't hurt anybody, and certainly never mortally hurt anybody. And it's got to, in some way, make sense to middle-class people, which is what happened with the civil rights movement. It had many sympathizers, even among people that didn't march, and it converted some people. One of the things that's built into Christianity is this whole thing about forgiveness and conversion. I can change my mind, they're saying. And King used that. He never talked against white people like some people did later. He talked against racists.
Mm-hmm.
But I can get over being a racist. I can get over being a sexist. I can get over being a homophobe. I can change. I can convert. But you can't change people's color, or at least very easily change their gender. Their sexual orientation thing. So that's the trick. It's very, very hard, and I think it's the key. The other thing, Alan, I just throw it in, and people will be upset, but if there's one thing I learned 30, 40 years ago in the 60s, is that the whole idea is to transform the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
But all the major leftists in America disagreed with that, and you know what? They all backed Ralph Nader. In the year 2000, they get mad when I say this, and Ralph Nader would not back off in Florida. He even went down there 3 or 4 days before the election, and he won just enough votes. He was out to teach Gore a lesson, but he not only taught Gore a lesson, he put George Bush in office. Now, I know there were other factors that led to Gore's loss.
Well, that
there's one thing. All leftists had left on voting day was their vote, their own vote. That was their last piece of power, and enough people gave that power in New Hampshire and Florida to George Bush to put him in office. And so you cannot do third parties. And I'm just always afraid that as memory dims about what happened in 2000, once again, people will come back and they will say, oh, we got to start a third party.
Well, it's a whole other can of worms we don't have time for today on the show.
Okay.
But, I mean, we've seen a lot of disappointment with Obama that he isn't really much of an alternative. So it's complicated. But
it sure is. But it ain't George Bush.
No,
and
it isn't.
That's why I say, you don't start if you don't want to be in the Democrat, if you don't want to move him leftward, then just be in a social movement. But third party is tremendous waste of people's energy and time once you get beyond the city level. And so I just find it a tragic thing that all these well-meaning people in the Green Party with a great platform, great values, and yet they're never going to get anywhere beyond the local level.
Well,
Alan, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah,
it has. You got me all wound up and going, and I did.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, and I do hope we see those social movements come together and that we'll live to see this all turn around.
Yeah, Radio Free Santa Cruz.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for coming on. And again, your website is whorulesamerica.net.
Yes.
And so people
just
can...
Just put my name in, Domhoff, D-O-M-H-O-F-F, and it'll come up.
Yeah,
on
William
Google.
Domhoff. Uh-huh.
Just Domhoff.
Okay.
It'll come up on Google.
Okay. Well, again, thank you very much, and look forward to it. Maybe someday we can have you on again. And
Well, I'm far away right now, as you know. I'm far from Santa Cruz, but it's nice to talk to Santa Cruz.
Okay. Well, again, thank you, and have a great trip.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. When the dust all settled, the sun shone.